and proceed to case number three. Thank you both for your help. Fleming versus the NLRB.
Good morning. My name is Charles Elmer. I'm one of the counsel for the petitioner Fleming Companies Incorporated, the Memphis General Merchandise Division. In this case, Fleming petitions to review and set aside an order of the National Labor Relations Board arising from unfair labor practice charges filed in connection with a campaign to organize one of Fleming's warehouses in Memphis, Tennessee in 1997.
Could I just ask you, as a point of idle curiosity, why this is in our court instead of the Sixth Circuit? Because last I checked, that Memphis is not in any of our states.
I'm not entirely sure. I was not involved in that decision making. My understanding that the procedural rules give a petitioner and the board a certain degree of
Well, that's right. But where do you do business within Illinois, Wisconsin, or Indiana? Hopefully somewhere, or it doesn't belong here.
I believe that there is a business operation in that area. I cannot tell you exactly where.
Illinois is where you do your business.
Excuse me.
Okay, I mean, as I said, it's a technical point, although there could be a case where it's an important point.
Okay.
Let me just say that I, too, was very quizzical about this because it did seem a little like forum shopping.
Let me direct your attention, since I know time is short, to the question of the Guardian Industries decision in this court and the bulletin board issue on which the board split. The analogy in this case, in the Guardian case that is, was drawn to employment discrimination law and other areas where the question was, shouldn't we be treating like cases alike, and what's the obligation to treat different cases differently? My question for you is, if we take the analogy to employment discrimination law one step further, then direct evidence of discriminatory animus is actually usually the best way to prove discrimination. And so why isn't it relevant here that the board had direct evidence of discriminatory animus with respect to these bulletin boards?
I would respond very simply by saying that the judge and the board made no finding that anti-union animus was related to these Section 8A1 violations. They did not rely on any finding of animus to reach those findings or to affirm them.
Well, I thought the board said that there was, maybe this is just in their brief, you know, that there was significant evidence of that. And also I found curious in Fleming's position the insistence that the bulletin board rule never allowed non-company materials to be there. You over and over again said no. Now, the administrative law judge discredited that testimony but inferred from what he saw in the overall course of conduct over the years that there was some de facto rule about allowing personal type announcements, whether it was wedding announcements or for sale items. But you claimed that there was no such rule, that you had people sweeping through and taking even personal things off the bulletin board. What is your position at this point? Did you have, as in Guardian, a policy that allowed personal things, or did you have a policy that forbade everything but company materials?
We had a policy that forbade anything other than postings for company business purposes.
All right, that's Section 12, whatever it was of your.
Had the company ever threatened to terminate an employee for posting a notice related to a group or organization?
No, there is no evidence in this record.
Is there any evidence in the record about how quickly the company removed postings that would be related to groups rather than individuals?
General counsel makes the argument in support of its anti-union animus argument.
Right, which it is at least arguing whether you think it's well taken or not.
Right. I mean, they raise this issue, and they argue it extensively in their briefs, that, you know, this sort of prompt, quick taking down of union literature from the bulletin boards in the break room suggests, you know, some form of animus. We would note that the same person, Stanley Jones, who put the material up in the boardroom, also put up, I believe, a thank you card, a personal one, and his supervisor, warehouse supervisor, took it down that morning twice.
Did they call him on the floor in front of lots of other employees to scold him for putting that one up?
For the personal posting or the union?
The personal postings. I know they did.
I don't believe
there's
any evidence one way or the other. What happened was the warehouse supervisor took the posting down, gave it to another employee, and sent a message, basically, please don't put this up.
Right, and that... Oh, sorry.
Did you say please?
I don't know that that was actually in the record, John. I want to address for a moment again the anti-union animus aspect of this. There really was no finding in the judge's order or even in the board's affirmance of it of any anti-union animus which motivated these violations. They are pure 8A1 violations.
Well, the thing that concerns me is I know the board is saying that there was, in fact, stepping back a half a step further than you want to from the record, there was evidence of that in the incident with respect to Doc Lee and the incident, although I know it's one of the things you're challenging, with respect to the delivery of the interview notice to, I think it was Ms. Reynolds, that there was evidence that there was opposition to the union, I think particularly the Lee incident, which you're not appealing. And so perhaps you're arguing that simply needs to be cordoned off from what happened at the bulletin board, but I know that the general counsel thinks we need to look at this more as a whole.
I would rely in making my point on decisions of this court and others where the board's decision stands or fall on their express findings and reasoning. And here they did make very specific factual findings and very well-developed and articulated reasoning for finding violations of 8A1. And they did not mention anything about anti-union animus in connection with those. Those issues did arise, admittedly, with respect to other issues, but not those. And we would argue that the discrimination standard, which was employed by the judge and by the board, did not in any way rely on this anti-union animus. They relied squarely on the board's standard of discrimination, which we say was rejected in this court's decision in Guardian Industries.
But, of course, Guardian leaves the door open. Judge Easterbrook's opinion in Guardian says specifically... this is around page 319, says the board does not contend that certain broadsides were still being posted. It does not say that the employer stopped allowing them in order to curtail claims by unions for access, and here's what caught my attention, which might imply a forbidden animus. So the Guardian opinion leaves the door open for a finding of discrimination that's supported by a forbidden animus. It just... As the court says there, that wasn't that case, and so they didn't need to rest it on any such thing.
I agree. I've noticed that also in that decision, but I would reiterate that that was no finding of that in this particular case. And if they had, I think it could have changed the analysis. Thank you. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
All right, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case is in this court because the company averred that they transact business within this judicial circuit, and that is permissible forum shopping under the NLRA. But I hope you're going to send the company home with an empty cart because they really don't get any relief from Guardian Industries.
Guardian looks awfully close to their case, though.
Yes, it is.
I mean, Guardian is a case where There's a personal versus organizational distinction. The ALJ finds that that's exactly what's happening here. How can we, without overruling Guardian, do anything but agree with Chairman Hertgen's dissent?
There's a crucial distinction between Guardian in this case, and that is one that the court later pointed out in J.C. Penney, and namely, it's that in Guardian, the company had and enforced a neutral policy that strictly prohibited all personal postings except for anonymous swap and shop notices. Here, the case hinges on the fact that although the company nominally had a written policy prohibiting all employee postings, in fact, the company turned a blind eye, and that's not the policy that they followed.
Forgive me, what is an anonymous swap and shop? I mean, how can you be anonymous and swap and shop?
I don't
Guess
know.
Guess who I am?
I'm not certain, and I don't think the case describes it, but I would imagine maybe it has a number or something instead of a person's identification.
See, my problem is that the ALJ went so far as to say, and I'm going to quote, if the test were individual slash group action, then I would find that Fleming's practice of permitting the posting of personal interest notices does not disparately disfavor notices of union activities or notices from unions in violation of Section 8A1 of the Act. Why isn't that enough under Guardian Industries to resolve the board?
Well, first of all, the board disavowed that statement in its decision, and the board rightly pointed out that what makes this case different is that when Manager Gaither told Mr. Jones that when he immediately removed the union notice, he said, we don't allow any postings. And that simply wasn't true. This is very much like a pretext case.
That's why I get back to the animus question. It seems to me that if the rule of law encompasses some legitimate consideration of that, then maybe the board at least has an argument. I'm not sure if it's a prevailing one after Guardian. But what you have on your side is, number one, the fact that they disavowed the rule that the ALJ inferred. So there's some question, you know, if you're alleging something that's untrue, then maybe we don't believe anything else you're saying either. And secondly, this other atmospheric evidence, which, as your opponent points out, the board isn't really talking about when it upholds this bulletin board, but maybe that's legitimate to consider, but it's not too much.
Oh, I think it's more than adequate to distinguish this case from Guardian and to support a finding. Remember, this is a Section 8A1 violation. The question is whether the employer's action restrained or coerced employees' activities.
Of course, in Guardian, the swap and shop is actually employer-sponsored, right? They give the things to the employer. The employer types up the little note card.
That's true. And this
and
is different.
Here it's an alleged non-policy that turns out to be a policy that turns out maybe not to be a policy.
Right, right. And so although certainly evidence, anti-union evidence isn't required under Section 81 of the Act, it is, as here, very probative. And the board's decision focuses on the fact that this, unlike previous situations, the company acted very hastily. They removed the notice immediately, whereas typically, although the company might remove notices, it wouldn't be for a period of days or weeks.
I will.
You go ahead.
Do you have any evidence that postings were ever allowed for organizations?
No, but
the
crucial...
Isn't the answer no?
No.
Yeah.
But the crucial factor is that the company... this is different from Guardian because the company simply, in effect, had no restrictions. They didn't follow their established policy of prohibiting all employee
notices.
See, it
seems to me, as I sit here, but believe me, you know, I'll be reading Guardian Industries again, that under Guardian Industries, that fact is determinative, that the company didn't treat union literature differently from, you know, the Salvation Army, the Hare Krishnas, the anyone else. And thus didn't, you know, violate the labor law.
That's crucial, and no one had ever been, as my opponent concedes, never been threatened for the mere fact of posting a notice before, threatened in front of other employees, and if that doesn't restrain or coerce. So would you, could we focus for just 1 second separately on the way in which Mr. Jones was approached, because that's somewhat separate from the question whether something was allowed to be on the bulletin board or not. He had put something that fell outside the terms of the company's policy on the bulletin board, as all these other things fell outside the terms of the policy. And instead of being quietly taken to one side and having it returned to him, having somebody say, this is outside the terms of the policy, please don't do this again, as my colleague said, using the word please, he was dressed down in front of, before he becomes insubordinate. Now, I know the company then goes on to say, well, the reason he got disciplined was that he was insubordinate, but I'm trying to focus on the couple of minutes before that.
Exactly.
Manager Gaither told Mr. Jones, if we ever catch you posting any more materials on this board again, then you will be subject to discipline up to and including discharge. And that all occurred before Mr. Jones got argumentative and then was in fact disciplined. That's not an issue. But no one had ever been subjected to a threat like that for the mere fact of having posted materials. And it's also relevant that he put this material...
How do you know this, please?
Oh, it's in the record. And in fact, it's
no
admitted.
No one has ever been disciplined before for actions like this?
Manager Gaither admitted that in his testimony, that no one had previously been... threatened with discipline for posting.
Could I ask you something totally different? The reply brief notes that there are errors in the facts, some of which might materially affect the argument. Is there anything you want to retract or...
I did notice that I had written in my digest of the transcript that one notice was posted for three, I can't remember whether it was weeks or months, but actually I think it was 3 days. It's not a material difference, and that was an error. And
what about, you know, the other errors that are noted?
Well, I did write a letter to the court about Mr. Zweig not, yeah, he was in an eligible
brief, right.
That was a typo. But I don't believe there's anything material in there. As far as the time clock notices, why employees clocked in early, first of all, that's not material. The main fact is that they had this rule, but it's an inference from the fact that the clock, a non-home clock, would allow an employee to post in early, that's why they used the clock. Any further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Let me, if I can, address the findings of the judge with respect to our policy and practice. We did have a policy which basically limited the boards to company purposes only. Excuse me?
Can you talk louder?
Yes, Your Honor. The judge found that we had this policy, as we do, of limiting the boards to company purposes only. He found that alongside it, there was a separate practice, which, as he said, sort of turned an eye to these personal postings.
Well, which is it, though? I mean, you either really had a policy of company material only, or certainly after Guardian, I don't know why you wouldn't have argued. No, as a matter of fact, we had a policy that also allowed for these birth announcements, et cetera, personal things. You avidly disclaimed that. He found that over your objection.
Yes, we oppose that finding because we do have this policy, and of course our client believes that it does enforce that policy and has done so. However, the ALJ made these findings, really what we say is on a handful, about five or six postings over a period of, I think, a year or so. You have cumulative testimony about many of the same kinds of things. For instance, three witnesses talked about the same Wendy's invitation.
Right. Could I ask you, though, quickly about the approach to Mr. Jones for the violation of the company policy? If people are,
If the policy is enforced differentially, depending on whether it's a birth announcement that, you know, the manager just goes and says, look, you know, I'm sorry, the bulletin boards are just for company business, here's your birth announcement, quietly, no embarrassing situation, and, you know, the union thing is given back to a person in front of everybody and he's told he's going to be fired if he keeps up with it, isn't that a coercive act? Doesn't that raise different concerns?
My understanding of the facts is that, yes, he was approached, and he was approached not in an office but in this open area. However, Mr. Jones, as the record reflects, has a long history of insubordination.
He didn't become insubordinate until after this had been said to him. I agree with you that the record shows that he had this history, but I guess I don't know why, had it been done the same way it was done elsewhere, he would have had, first of all, there wouldn't have been a whole host of witnesses standing around to see it. I don't know what he would have done. But if you could just maybe respond briefly.
I cannot dispute the basic fact that he was addressed. Discipline was discussed with him openly. It was. But previously there had been no the context of Mr. Jones is insubordinate behavior at the time, but there is no particular evidence in the record dealing with a comparable situation.
What?
A comparable situation, excuse me.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Court will take this case under advisement. We will.